low temperature in physics research, in modern physics research or frontier physics. So what I'm trying to do is just share what I've done during the past years with you guys. And I selected the five examples, if time allows. The first example is pure physics. The remaining four examples is the application of ULT technology in frontier physics. And the two of them are basically like facilities, and the two of them are specific applications. Okay. And the thing is the following. Frontier physics is a very wide range topic. You know, be honest with you, my job is to provide ultra low temperature environment to the scientist. Okay. I not necessarily know all the frontier physics details, and it's impossible to know everything. And also, it's not possible to cover everything within 50 minutes, these type of things. Okay? So my job is to provide a ultra-low temperature platform, and sometimes include the high field magnet and ultra-high vacuum environment, these type of things. Okay? So today is to share this information with people. So, when we talk about ultra low temperature, how low is ultra low? There's no international definition, and my own definition is below 1 Kelvin, because up to 77 Kelvin, you can buy liquid nitrogen. You pump it, you get a 68 K. You spend the money, buy liquid helium, you get 4.2 K. You pump it, you get a 1.5 K. But in order to get below 1 Kelvin, you have to do some special approaches. For example, you can depressurize the liquid helium 3, you get a 0.3 K. However, you cannot buy liquid helium 3. So now, why do we need ultra low temperature? Okay, people say, all right, the lower temperature, the lower thermal noise, the better signal to noise ratio, these type of things. This is correct. But the major important thing is ultra low temperature really lead a lot of new discovery in physics. And it's safe to say, every time when people push the temperature to the lower level, new physics popped up. This is the important thing. So here, I just listed a few like typical applications. Of course, my PhD thesis was doing superfluid helium 3. The discovery of superfluid helium 3 actually is one of the most prominent applications of ultra low temperatures. Okay, so. Now, how do we get ultra-low temperature? Today, we really don't have time to get all these details. But in the laboratory, for the time being, the people normally use two different systems. One is called the helium-3 systems. One is called the dilution refrigerators. So now the thing is, for these systems, the coolant is helium. Okay, be very careful. It's different from when you buy this liquid helium in your pre-cool systems. This, I'm talking about coolant, okay? So let's see how a helium 3 system works. So first of all, look at the phase diagram. For helium 3, basically, the phase diagram normally is a 2D diagram, two dimension, like the P and the T. It's called a PT diagram. For PT diagram, normally you start looking at the two curves. One is the coexistence curve between solid and liquid. The second one is between the liquid and the gas. Everyone knows, for single material, this type of phase transition is the first order phase transition. Described by the Clausius-Clapeyron equation, dP/dt. Right? So now we're talking about the depressurized liquid helium 3. So we focus on this curve. Right, so basically here you can see there's a wider range of on the phase diagram you can get helium 3. So let's start. So what happened is you buy some helium 3 gas. You can buy helium 3 gas. You cannot buy helium 3 liquid. For the time being, now U.S. government is treated the helium 3 gas as a strategic material. The thing is basically they did not allow non-U.S. users to buy helium 3 gas. So we have to buy from other resource. Luckily, I work it out with American company. He has a channel to work with these Russian guys. Okay, we call the Russian mafia. Okay, so he import the Russian gas into U.S. He resell, but the price is three times higher than for the U.S. Users. But good news is at least we can get helium-3 gas. So you've got, let's say, 10 liters, whatever it is. So now you build a bottle, stainless bottle, 1 liter, you got 10 liter bar pressure, 10 liter atmosphere pressure gas here. Then you build something called a 1K pot. I think everyone understands what 1K pot is. 1K pot is a cylindrical thing. So you put the 4K liquid, you depressurize, you get 1.5K. So you create some environment or condition in this area. So very quickly, you can collect the liquid, okay, according to the phase diagram. This is the liquid phase. So now liquid is heavier than is heavier. So basically, you build another pot container at the bottom. So the liquid just stop dropping. Okay. So you collect the liquid helium 3 here. It's very simple. So next step is depressurize. You have two ways to depressurize. One is just build a charcoal pump, use natural charcoal. Then you cool down the charcoal, you depressurize. Okay, the second way is you remove the charcoal, you put an external pump. But this external pump has to be hermetically sealed because the helium-3 gas is very expensive. You don't want to lose it. You don't want to air get contaminated helium-3 gas. Now, when you buy a pump, you have to be careful. You have to really buy a hermetic pump. Normally, our criterion is 10 to minus 8 leak rate, at least. And actually, when you spray helium leak detector, you even did not detect the signal. But you have to be careful, because not all the company really understand what you want. So when you say, I want hermetic pump, I can guarantee you, every company say, my pump is hermetic, okay? It's minus 5, minus 6. You can calculate, if you get leak rate minus 5, then you can see, after 1 year, how many air you get in. Okay, so, all right. So now, you're good. You got the liquid helium 3. And you get the charcoal pump, you pump it, then what you do is you will see, you get there. You get this below 300 millikelvin. Yesterday, I was giving a talk at the Bangalore. One professor asked me how long you can maintain this temperature. Janice research have a standard design, and with 6 liter NTP liter helium-3 gas, if you pump the 1K pot and keep the 1K pot 1.5K, which means you mainly only get the heat load from 1.5K to 0.3K, which is delta T of 1.2K, then the holding time is 1 week, which is 168 hours. Normally, I quote 100 hours to play safe. Just let you know. And if you want longer holding time, you just increase the quantity. Basically, the holding time is proportional to the quantity. But you cannot change the base temperature by adding more helium-3 gas, because the base temperature is dominated by the vapor, saturated vapor pressure of helium-3. Just keep in mind, just different concept. All right, so next we talk about the dilution. Dilution refrigerator is another most frequently used system in the laboratory. Okay, and this is the only system which can be continuously operated, and with the base temperature around 10 millikelvin, below 10 millikelvin, with a relatively larger cooling power. This is the only system in the world that people can use. So this dilution fridge is a very, very popular thing. Okay. So how dilution works? So now, instead of PT phase diagram, you have a T-chi phase diagram. So what is chi? Chi is so-called a helium-3 concentration in the coolant. So what happens is, if you have helium 4, you can get the 4.2K. If you have a pure helium 3, you get 0.3K. But the funny thing is, you put together, you get 10 millikelvin. This is a funny thing. Okay, what happened? So you put together, you cool the system down. Okay, so for example, assuming you have 20% of the we call a mixture. Okay. 20% mixture is helium-3, so the chi is 0.2. And actually, this is the ratio we make a dilution, because this is a kind of universal ratio. So when you cool down, of course, you become a liquid. So the funny thing is, when you reach about 0.5 Kelvin, this liquid starts separating by itself into two parts. One part has richer and richer helium-3, and the one part has less and less helium-3. For the first part, has a more and more helium-3, people call it condensed phase, and the other part is called a diluted phase. And because helium-3 is lighter than helium-4, the concentrated phase just floating up. So what happened is the concentrated phase floating up. So what happened is this the gray stuff is the concentrated phase, and the dark one is the diluted phase. Okay, which has more healing flow. All right, so we have a phase diagram, which you design something like a pot. Okay, this is a chamber we call the mixing chamber. So here we go. So now what's next? Next is that, just keep in mind, that time the temperature is around 1 Kelvin. So next is this dilution fridge become a U-tube. So here at the top of the U-tube of right-hand side, we have another chamber we call the steel. The steel is half empty, half full. So half empty means here we filled with some vapor. So what is this vapor? Now the issue is you should look at the saturated vapor pressure of helium 3 and the helium 4 at that temperature, like between 0.9K and 1K. You will find at that temperature, the saturated vapor pressure of helium 3 is almost like a 2 to 3 order magnitude higher than helium 4. So basically, this chamber is filled with helium 3 vapor. That is a very lucky thing, because that time, if you remove, you pump it, you put an external pump, you remove, you start pumping this this steel. Although this is a diluted phase, there's a very little helium 3 there. However, what you pump it out is helium 3, 95%, because the vapor pressure is much, much higher than helium 4. And the funny thing is, even that time, even the helium 3 vapor pressure is not high at all. You really have to heat it up. So you have to put a steel heater. Normally, you know, you heat up a control like at like a 0.8K, whatever it is. Because once you pump it, it can go below 0.7K. 0.7K, you cannot pump out anything, because both helium 3 and helium 4, the vapor pressure is too low. So you have to heat it up. This is a very strange thing. This is the only place I can think of is when you want to get the very low temperature, you have to heat it. Okay, this is a very lucky thing. So now, what happens if you pump helium 3 out? Once you pump helium out, you destroy the chemical potential, the balance here. So the helium 3 gas from the concentrated phase has to cross the boundary and enter this area, and to keep the correct ratio. And then people did a very good measurement, measured the enthalpy of the helium 3 gas in the diluted phase and also in the concentrated phase. People find the entropy of helium 3 gas in the diluted phase is much higher than the concentrated phase, which that means when this gray helium 3 gas passed the boundary to the dark blue helium 3 gas, the enthalpy increased dramatically. That means it has to absorb heat from the environment. This is the cooling process. So dilution fridge is that simple. It's not difficult, it's very simple. The difficult part actually is how to intercept the heat load with this warming gas. This is people have to make a very effective heat exchanger. That is the difficult part. Okay, so today we have no time to talk about how to make heat exchanger. We can talk about the coffee time. So this is something just keep in mind. Okay, so basically both helium 3 crystal and the dilution, the working mechanism is to remove helium 4, helium 3 atom. But for helium 3 system, you use the latent heat of helium 3. For dilution, you are utilizing the difference of the enthalpy of the helium 3 atom in the diluted phase and the concentrated phase. Then, in order to compare apple to apple, this curve normalized compared to the same rate of removal helium 3 gas. See what happened. So you can see, for helium 3 systems, you can only reach 0.3K or below, 0.25, whatever it is. But it has pretty big cooling power, which means you apply heat, the temperature did not go up quickly. However, the dilution fridge can reach below 10 millikelvin, but it has a limited cooling power. This is the cooling power. All right, so when you design something or when you apply research funding, and you have to think through in advance what you want to achieve, okay? If you want to achieve, if you only need something like a 700 millikelvin, helium-3 is a good candidate because it has a larger cooling power. But if you need something below 400 millikelvin, you have to use dilution. All right. So now this is the background. Let's talk about example. The first example is measurement of the Cooper pair breaking edge of superfluid helium 3 B phase. So what happened is everyone knows these are the three guys, which is the Cornell, which discover the superfluid helium 3. All right. This is a senior professor David Lee, and this is a junior professor at that time, Bob Richardson. It is this is a graduate student, Doug Ashraf. Okay. So what happened is in 1973. What happened is they are interested in the helium-3 study. So that time, long time ago, people already discovered the superfluid helium-4. So now, all these theorists, started studying helium-3, although helium-3 is a fermion system. So the theorists are convinced helium-3 fermion system will become superfluid at certain temperatures. So they keep developing different models, and they have to predict that transition temperature is in the microkelvin range. So this experimentalist say forget it, because in 1973 you can never get a stable microkelvin. So they look for something else. So the theorist also told them, listen, for solid helium-3 there's a new phase at around the 2 millikelvin. They say that's doable. So what happened is they built a special Pomerantz cell. Pomerantz cell is a very special setup that can reach very low temperature using so-called Pomerantz cooling effect, which is developed by the Russian scientist Pomerantz. It's a very, there's a rich physics and a very interesting, and the Pomerantz cell is a very, they develop a very clever cell. If people are interested, we can talk about the coffee time, but the Pomerantz experiment itself will cover 1 hour. So, all right. So what happened is they did find a glitch. Okay, they are convinced this is a phase transition. So, and inside the Pomerantz cell there is solid helium-3. So they published a new paper in the early 1973, I believe, that they say they found a new phase in the solid helium-3. And this, because this paper, these three persons got a Nobel Prize. And ironically, this paper was wrong. And what they found turned out to be is the long-waiting discovery of superfluid helium-3 in a transition. So they are great physicists. Very quickly, they realized, wait a minute, I have two samples in my Pomerantz cell. One is solid, one is liquid. How can I know this kind of glitch is not coming from the liquid? So immediately they did a bunch of experiments. One is to check the NMR signal of solid, because this NMR, solid has a very strong NMR signal, and they did not see any change. However, they found different peaks. They say, wait a minute, it's from liquid. Okay, it's very convincing. So quickly they wrote a second paper, which is the correct paper. So, all right. So now the thing is the following. What's the microscopic mechanism of the transition? He is the great theorist, Tony Leggett, from University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. He developed a detailed microscopic theory to explain the mechanism of the superfluid helium-3. He said this is a P wave, and also because helium-3 is a fermion, so spin, the wave function has to be anti-symmetrical, so this is a spin triplet. So think about it, P wave, the angular momentum has three possibility. Spin triplet, three possibility. 3 × 3, 9 possibility. Real and imaginary, 18 possibility. So helium-3 physics is a very rich physics, okay? It has a lot of possibility of this is called a quantum state. But the bottom line is what? Bottom line is the mechanism is still BCS theory. Is BCS theory, the core of the BCS theory is this particle has to form Cooper pair. So now the important thing is, because that time it was a pretty early time, so it's very nice if we can have a direct observation of Cooper pair. This is one thing. Of course, in order to prove this second order transition, people did different things. For example, people measure the heat capacity jump. people measure the viscosity, these type of things. Okay, but then I did basically measure this Cooper pair breaking edge. So what it means is the following. People know that for superconductivity or superfluid, whatever it is, when you hit the PTC, then the Cooper pair start, these two particles start forming Cooper pair, the particle around the Fermi surface, okay? Then once you form the Cooper pair, the total free energy of the system drop below the Fermi surface. So total energy is lower than the original when you fill up the Fermi surface. This is why we form superconductivity. So now if you give this system a little bit energy, if you forget the binding energy of this Cooper pair, then if your energy is equal or greater than 2 delta, delta is the energy gap. Oh, by the way, that time system will form an energy gap around the Fermi surface. This is everyone knows. Then you can break the Cooper pair and excite them into so-called continuum regime, this type of thing. Okay? So now the thing is, if your energy is right at the 2 delta, then it's called a Cooper pair breaking edge. So what happens is, here we go. And theoretically, at the zero temperature, the gap is determined by TC with this relationship, which is everyone knows. Then near TC, I call it empirical formula, whatever it is. Okay? So this the gap as a function of T near TC is dominated by this this formula. It's not valid way below TC, okay? Just the yellow area. So now what happened? The idea, before we do experiment, you should have some ideas. So what's the idea? Idea is if we plot BCS gap of the superfluid helium-3, then we plot 2 delta, then if we send some acoustic sound phonon into the liquid, okay, with a fixed frequency, the frequency is energy, okay, at the very beginning, just above TC, forget it, there's no Cooper pair, okay, just below TC, the gap is very small. Of course, that time you have a fixed frequency, your phonon frequency, your energy is larger than 2 delta, because that time delta is very small. And then you should not see any signal, okay, suppose you have a signal generator, you have a receiver, you should not see anything. That's right, because this phonon energy was absorbed by the Cooper pair to break the Cooper pair. This is the idea. So when you keep cooling, the energy gap will get larger. When the H bar omega right hit the 2 delta, it should stop the absorption, then the ultrasound should pass. This is the idea. All right, so what happened is, but overall, the attenuation of the superfluid to the ultrasound is pretty high. So you have to be very careful to design something, the gap is very small. So we call it a narrow gap. So how narrow? I think I put a gold wire of 119 micrometer. I put a 2 Z-cut transducer. Z-cut means a longitudinal wave. And with, I think, the base frequency like 12.5 megahertz, these type of things. Then you can excite the odd harmonic. All right? So what happened is there's a 2 transducer, 1, 2, and this is spacer, forget it. It's spring-loaded. So at the beginning, the idea is send a pulse to use time-of-flight technology and see if this guy can receive it. And actually, the funny thing is, this is an experiment is done around the 1 millikelvin, right? Around this 1.5, okay? The TC is about 2. At that pressure is 1.9 millikelvin. You can believe, you can imagine. That time I was a student, actually. There was no computer. I used chart recorder, and all this electronics is very complicated. You have to make everything working, then working. Everything was working, but suddenly this transducer died. Okay, so we changed the strategy. Rather than use the pulse, time flight technology, we send a continuous wave. So in this case, what happened is, between these two transducers, it became a standing wave. So the reason I'm telling you is the following. So this kind of thing is not, you're not seeing what is it, sine wave. This is the phase change at the of the standing wave on this transducer. Just to let you know. Okay, just don't misunderstand. But the physics is the same. So what happened is we cool down. Then we have a change of the impedance, acoustic impedance. We get a TC. Then suddenly there's no signal because that time the energy of the phonon was taken by breaking the air Cooper pair. Then suddenly the signal start very clearly. That is where the phonon energy equals to delta. Because the frequency is very well defined. We know what it is. Okay, this type of transducer is very sharp. Okay, the frequency is very, very precise. And we know the coefficient has to be 2. So then we compare the theory. That time, actually, people already developed so-called strong coupling or BCS theory. People know that the liquid helium is not like an electron in a pure metal. There's a very strong correlated system. The interaction is very strong. Okay, so people developed the so-called strong coupling metal model, or called a weak coupling plus, whatever it is. However, there's another issue people have to consider, which is the temperature scale. That time, really, it's a kind of in the early stage, people really did not have international well-developed temperature scale. First of all, we have Cornell's temperature scale, we have a Helsinki temperature scale, then we have this so-called Gray Wall temperature scale. Gray Wall is the person working with AT&T. And actually, he is probably the best. Okay, so we combine them together, and we found that the data we can fit the best is a combination of strong coupling model plus Gray Wall temperature. So we kind of directly, this is a direct proof of existence of Cooper pair in superfluid helium 3. Then we also, our results support the Gray Wall temperature scale. Also, we support the weak coupling plus, which is a strong coupling model in superconductivity. All right, this is, yeah, go ahead. Now, this oscillation is the phase change of this standing wave at the acting transducer. This is not sine wave, this is what I'm saying. Okay, for details, we can talk at the coffee. Yes, exactly. It's not sine wave. Then, of course, there's another peak. Forget this peak. This peak is the interaction between the sound phonon and a collective mode. This is another rich physics. So actually, we got another physical review, publication about this. You can see we resolve this double split, a double peak, peak. Okay. So anyway, so because we're running out of time. The second example is the ultra-low temperature, 10 millikelvin, high, ultra-high vacuum STM. Everyone knows STM, right? STM is the most powerful, one of the most powerful approach to study material in the physics in the real space. So what happened is Janice is working with this person, is Dr. Joe Strasio at the NIST of Gaithersburg, United States, to develop a novel, powerful, I'm not saying next generation, but it's a novel. It's a very good STM, 10 millikelvin ultra high vacuum high field. So one thing I have to say for the next four examples, okay. Basically, I carefully selected the application from different fields, but for each example. We will ask three questions. The first question is, what does the system want to achieve? The second question is, what's the challenge in order to achieve this goal? The third question is, how do we meet the challenge? These three questions, okay? So, what this this guy want to do? He say, first of all, I want 10 millikelvin. This is no problem. The dilution can reach below 10. Then he say, I want ultra-high vacuum, 10 to minus 10. Again, I gave another talk in China 2 weeks ago, focused on UHV. So how to design UHV, what's the fabrication, what's the material selection, which is another 2-hour talk. But anyway, just keep in mind, there's no international definition of UHV. I remember about 15 years ago, people talk about 10 or minus 8. Then people say 10 minus 9. Nowadays, nobody likes 10 or minus 10. People want 10 minus 10. And more than that, people want a room temperature vacuum tandemized tank. Because if you cool down, there's a huge cryo pump. People say it doesn't come. All right, so that just needs a special design and a careful selection of material. It's not no big deal, and we have done many. Then 15 Tesla magnet, not big deal. We work with the Cryo Magnetics. That time is another company. It's not big deal. So the issue is the vibration. So vibration basically, he is a very experienced STM guy. So basically he said what he wants is the STM tip and the sample fluctuation is around 100, within 100 femtometer, 10 to the minus 15 femtometer. This is very small. So in order to do this, he said, he set up a goal. He said, if you use some, geophone, whatever it is, to measure the reduction of the vibration, then he said, at the 25 hertz, the total vibration reduction should be 100 dB. So now what do we do? Vibration came from two different resources. One is called from external resource, from people walking, and the train past the earth, and then you have to have the pumping station. If for dry heat dilution, now we have a compressor, these type of things. Then you have to circulate, they have a big pipe, okay? This is one thing. So in order to deal with this, we did the following things. Okay, again, this is a joint project. Janice did something, and he did something, and we worked together on something. So the first thing we did is locate the lab 13 meters underground. This is a very, very expensive facility. I went there, okay, it's really very deep. So this time, to minimize all this noise, vibration coming from the Earth. Then more than that, he set up the 110-ton concrete mass, sit on the 6 vibration suspension with active cancellation with the natural frequency less than 1 hertz, okay? Because with this low frequency, it's kind of decoupled with the high Earth frequency from the Earth. Then he has a 6-ton graphite table, this ground thing, sit on the another 4 suspension with active cancellation with a red natural frequency of 2.5 hertz, sit on the green one. Then last one is the cryostat, which is about 1 ton. So his STM is, our dilution and STM is sit there. Okay, so that's it. However, you can really completely isolate the system from the external world, which is the pumping station. So what happened is we use gimbal. What a gimbal is? Gimbal is nothing. Just the 2 flange with a flexible bellow section. Now it's a commercial thing you can buy from McAllister. So one flange is connected to the stage with a higher level of vibration. And then one flange is connected to the stage with a low vibration. Basically, that's it. Okay? So now think about it. You have Earth, you have 110 ton, you have 6 ton, you have 1 ton. There are 4 stages with different level of vibration. Then you have 3 joints. Then at each joint, you put 1 gimbal. So if you look at this, sketch, you see 3 yellow things. The 3 yellow things is 3 gimbal. Don't worry about it, and because the Review of Scientific Instrument invited us to write a review article. You can easily find it from the Google, this type of thing. All right, so this kind of deal with the external vibration. So they looked at the internal vibration. Internal vibration is the vibration came from the fridge itself. Okay, the biggest problem is the 1K pot. You cannot avoid it. Because 1K pot is used to condense the mixture. So what happened is people find the problem is 1K pot, everyone knows, right? You pump the helium in 4 to get a 1K. So the problem is you have to get 4K of helium into the 1K. And when the 4K, which is the normal fluid, and 1.5K superfluid, and per article, it will generate so-called high flow turbulence. This turbulence generates this noise peak. This is the problem. So what happened? You have three ways to do things. One is you make a big 1K pump. So when you start scanning your sample, you close the needle valve, and you stop the 4K from going into the 1K pump. All right, this is fine. This is the kind of, it helps. But the problem, and actually we did it. But the problem is, nowadays people want to scan very long, like 72 hours. You cannot make a 1K pot like the room. You have to be limited, have a limited volume. All right, so the second thing is you install something called an acoustic noise reducer. So it's like here, which is very, very simple. Basically, you make this zipper longer, okay? So what happened like this, you make some copper coil, because coil around, around, around. So when the 4K come in, it's a pre-cooled inside the tube. When it comes out, it's already 1.5K. That works. And actually, there's a few publications verify the noise peak is gone, okay? But anything else? Yes. Then the third way is get rid of the 1K pot. This is because people say, wait a minute, no matter what, 1K pot could still be the problem. So the solution is remove the 1K pot and replace it with a JT crack cooler. So here we go. This is a sketch of the so-called formal official JT crack cooler. This is JT crack cooler. We simplified it. So what we do is we get a piece of like a bellows, like this, flexible one, because we need to bend it, like 7 to 10 inch long. Then we stick into it with a thin capillary, okay, which is 7 to 10 meter long, okay, very long. So what we do is we coil around, 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 then stuff into it. So the whole point is try to maximize the surface area, okay, to optimize the pre-cooling. So this actually is a heat exchanger, because we pump the cold gas from the outer barrel and put the return gas here. So with this design, then we successfully pre-cool the gas into this area, which the helium is, which the helium has the positive Joule-Thomson coefficient. Everyone knows, right? If you work outside here, when you expand, you're heating, not cooling. Okay, so you have to really have to pre-cool here. So the second part of our homemade JT cryo cooler is the impedance. Okay, so after impedance, you expand, you cool. Very simple. So, however, be honest with you, this is the first one in the world. Oh, by the way, all these examples are first thing in the world. Okay, so this is the interesting part. Both Janis and the Joe Strasio NIST did not know for sure if this design works for this fridge dilution. Even if it works, we don't know for sure how well it works. Is it better than 1K or not? So we designed the dual fridge with so-called hybrid. We installed both 1K pot and the JT in this fridge. Then we can compare. So what's the results? The results is the same. If you look at the review article, there are two important results. One is when you operate the 1K pot, we call it 1K pot mode, or you work at the JT, you call JT mode, at the same condition, circulation rate and things. The noise generated by the 1K pot. Oh, by the way, we installed the acoustic noise reducer for sure. But even though the noise generated by 1K pot is 1 to 2 order magnitude higher than JT. So JT is better. The second measurement NIST did is, you know dilution fridge. You know dilution fridge, you circulate. You know you can have a different circulation rate in order to get different cooling power, these type of things. So they tried to circulate at 100 micromole and at 200 micromole. And you can imagine when you circulate higher, you get a slightly higher vibration or noise. But for JT, but for 1K pot, the noise increase is twice as much as the JT when you circulate higher. Okay, so these are two important conclusions. So the conclusion is JT works and it works better. So nowadays, actually, after this system was successfully done, we got a lot of inquiry and we got a lot of orders. I will show you later on. So nowadays, people even remove the 1K pot, just let you know. Okay, so vibration. So this is the what the goal at the 20 hertz, 100 dB. So first of all, he measured between ground and 110 ton. He got 40 dB. Then between 110 ton to 6 ton, he got 40 dB. Between 6 ton and the dilution, he got 50 dB. So in total, he got the 130 dB reduction at the 25 hertz. So he reached the goal. All right, so this is Dr. Joe Strasio when he set up the fridge in NIST, these type of things. Okay, so then we got the invitation of the review of scientific instrument to write a review article. Then we plot the B over T versus year. And the red one is the UHV system, the blue one is non-UHV. So now the thing is the following. People should understand why B over T is important. I'm not going to explain now. So that time, we proudly put our system at the highest. Say this is number one in the world at that time, probably 5 years ago. However, this record was broken very quickly. Nowadays, these are the system which Janice is working on or already finished. So now I better point out two things which is interesting for the people here. One, Joe Strasio's NIST system is a top loading. He loaded the system from top. It is good at the bad. However, Max Planck, okay? Max Planck guy worked with me to develop a bottom loading system. Bottom loading system at least have a few, advantage. One is normally the field, magnetic field center is here. When you load it, the travel distance is shorter. The second of all, normally for this type of application, everyone has a so-called a sample prep chamber, UHV chamber, okay? So now you better have a larger pumping port to pump out the UHV. So here, people put the prep chamber here, people can put the very big pumping port. But think about it, if you put the pumping port here, you can only pass long tube here. It's not great. So bottom loading has that advantage. Third of all, this type of system normally is always two stories. It's very tall, these type of things, okay? And the top loading is always the pain. You have to climb up. So bottom loading, you have a nice chair, change sample. So there's, for engineering wise, you have a very obvious advantage of bottom loading. The second thing is here. That time, he needed 15 Tesla solenoid, which is not a problem. But nowadays, a lot of people are looking for a vector magnet. People want to rotate the field. For solenoid, it's not a problem even you get 17T, 18T. I think Oxford now is offering 18T, even 19T. But for vector magnet, nobody offers a 17T vector magnet, right? Okay. So what do we do? So there's a clever idea. So he said, instead of try to generate, to develop a high field vector magnet, which is not possible, why not I rotate sample? So this is a rotating STM. See here, it's moving. So the idea is put a rotating STM inside the solenoid. So you rotate the sample, this idea. So we are working on it. All right, so all these guys, actually the Institute of Physics of China, IOP, Institute of Physics IOP in China has bought two. So this type of system for different professors. So this system, this type of basic research is really booming. So next example is the so-called sub-Kelvin ARPAS. STM is measuring the sample in the real space, and the ARPAS is measuring space in the momentum space, which is called angle-resolved photoelectron spectroscopy. What happened is people send photon here, knock out the photon electron, and analyze the energy and the momentum of the electron and get insight information of the material. So the thing is the following. For all other experiments, even optical, you can put a window. You can put a coating to reduce the heat load, but not for ARPAS. ARPAS, you have to open the slot, let the photoelectron come out. Normally, the slot is 3 millimeter wide and 8 millimeter long. Even for that small slot, because the solid angle is very short, the distance between analyzer, room temperature analyzer and the sample is around 32 to 38 millimeters. So the heat load is 10 to 15 milliwatt. So what with this heat load, you can see the dilution will not work. So you have to think about helium-3. This is Dr. Borisenko in BESI in the Berlin Synchronous Center. And he wanted to develop the next generation ARPAS. This is really called the next generation. So he came to see me. He said, what is a good ARPAS? Good ARPAS needs three conditions. One is a good source, low energy with good resolution. The second is a good analyzer with a good resolution, of momentum and energy. The third one is low temperature. Okay, so they can minimize the thermal broadening and keep the sample in the ground state. You see, nowadays, because of the larger heat load, all the Abbas people have to get stuck into above 2 Kelvin for a long time. So what I need is below 1 Kelvin. Okay, so I say, all right, so we know the dilution will not work. The solution is to develop a high-power helium-3 systems. So I did it for him, and it works. The first Abbas in the world, it reached the 0.9 Kelvin. First sub-Kelvin Abbas. Okay, so actually he said that the German government told him, if you reach the below 1 Kelvin, I take your money back. But he succeeded. So this is his one of his publications, mapped by the Fermi surface. Then, of course, people get more and more demanding. Borisenko system has 4 degree freedom, X, Y, Z, and azimuthal rotation. But immediately, people say, no, I want more. This is a Caltech guy. He said, I want tilt. So tilt add one more interface, which is more difficult. So after more calculation, blah, blah, whatever it is, we develop following. First of all, we improve the design, whole design. Rather than 0.9 Kelvin, we reached 0.7 Kelvin on the cold finger. Then we cannot do anything, but there's a 180 millikelvin delta T along the braid, which is for the tilting. So we succeeded. We can tilt the plus minus 30 degree, and we got the 840 millikelvin on the sample. So this is now immediately the Chinese and the other people ordered. Okay, so now we develop the 5 degree freedom sub-Kelvin Abbas. Now actually more interesting, people start working with me to develop the dry Abbas system. All right. So next is so-called ultra-low temperature technology in cosmology physics. Cosmology physics is to study the origin of the Earth, the evolution of the Earth, these type of things. Okay, so for a long time, people set up the telescope at the 5,200 high mountain in Chile, called Akatama Cosmology Telescope. This is there for a while. However, everyone believed in the past that the universe is uniform. Now people find that it's not uniform, okay? There's just some temperature fluctuations type of things. So this group developed a new receiver, having 3,000 detectors, so-called TD, a transition edge detector. The superconducting transition temperature is 150 millikelvin. So they want something. So what they want? They want cryogen free. First of all, this is 5,200 high. So you cannot imagine to move liquid helium every day to the top of the mountain. It has to be cryogen free. Then they want the receiver put on the telescope, keep shaking or moving, plus minus 30 degree. And they want to keep the detector below 100 millikelvin so they can tune it at 150 millikelvin. And the last and the most challenging part is, in the past, they always use single shot helium-3 with some ADR, these type of things. And the problem is, think about it. At the top of the 5,200 meter mountain, high mountain, that is very cold, and if the operation cost is very high, and also you cannot take data the whole year. You have only certain limited time. So the efficiency is very, very important. It's really crucial for these guys. So they say, can you do something which we can continuously operate this system? Okay, the solution has only one solution, which is a dry dilution. That's it. All right, so dry dilution, everyone knows, is use pulse tube. And the thing is, pulse tube has three basic configuration, but for the commercial one from Crimec, people use called U-tube. U-tube configuration is people pull out the regenerator, either first stage or second stage, from the tube, okay? It's very useful, it's crucial for us, I will explain why. All right, so now for the wet dilution, we know we put the JT, and we can compare with the 1K good better is JT better. But for this dry system, we have no choice because we cannot have 1K. We don't have 1K pot. We have to use JT. So now everyone is the expert of JT. So with the same design, we pre-cooled the helium for three gas here, then we got the cooling. So this is the fridge we made. You can see it's very compact. Okay, this is only like that high. But of course, the whole receiver is not that small. It's pretty big. All right, so we test it, and it works. Then they put on the top of the mountain, their so-called sensor tower, 3,000 sensor. They can capture below 60 millikelvin. They're very, very happy. They already got the invite talk last March meeting. They're already collecting data. And the thing is, they told me this design improving their mapping speed by about 40%. This is really good improvement. Okay, then they can observe for twice as long. So they can take far more data during the limited time. So this is the application of this cosmology physics. Okay, now last example is so the hybrid quantum systems. Nowadays, everything is quantum. So people say, okay, atoms is a good candidate to store quantum state, but it's very difficult to manipulate. Superconductors are device are good candidate for processing. So this is why their idea is they combine these two systems together, and try to use the superconducting device as a processor. So their idea is the following. The idea is, give me a 10 millikelvin stuff. I put my superconducting device here, and then I trap some atom there to outside your system, which they use rubidium. They use laser cooling to cool down the atom. They put a set of coil to drive or guide the atom into the fridge. Then they put the trapping coil here, which is 10 millimeter below the superconducting device. They trap the atom here. Then they put a windows, they can shine lasers, they have CCD camera. This is the whole setup, okay? So the system is not that difficult. And we made it, it's already delivered to Singapore. That's a system. And we can see all these coils here. And we have the window opening at the bottom, we have shutters. The challenge is the leads. Because even inside our cryostat, there's six coils. Six coils having 12 leads. Okay, 12 leads. Now the thing is the following. This is something I want to share with you. For dry systems, we use positive. So we have vacuum shroud, room temperature. We have a first stage for 40K. We have second 3K. Then we have lower temperature. So between room temperature and the 40K, we use brass rod. The rod is a 3/32 diameter. Okay, brass rod, the good thing is the thermal conductivity is not very high, the conductive, so heat load is smaller. But the electrical resistivity is not that high either. It's a Wiedemann-Frenz law. It's a good compromise. For 5 ampere, it's pretty good. We test it. Then between first stage and second stage, we use high TC leads, these type of things. Okay, then below 3 Kelvin, below the second stage, below 3 Kelvin, we go back to the low TC leads, now we're in titanium, which has a 9.6 Kelvin transition temperature. Luckily, we don't have high field. We don't have to worry about H-series type of things. All right, so, but it didn't work, okay? Once we connected 12 leads, the second stage temperature got way too high that the dual fridge doesn't work because it's a dry fridge, dry system. We have to keep the second stage colder to condense the mixture. What happened is, people told me the wrong information. People told me the high TC, each high TC leads between 40K and 3K, the heat load is 3 milliwatt. But we turned out to be my measurement is 15 milliwatts. So if it is 3 milliwatts, the 12th lead is 36 milliwatts, my pulse tube can handle. But the 15 times 12, 180 milliwatt, my second stage cannot handle. It go up below about 4K. So what do we do? Okay, this is what do we do. I just said for the pulse tube, we use a so-called U-tube configuration. This is the second stage regenerator. Second stage regenerator has a very high excess of cooling power. People should use it as much as possible. So what happened is the top of the regenerator is first stage temperature, 40K. The bottom is second stage is 3K. So I found something in between. I found somewhere which is about 8K. So I put 8K plate, stage. I terminate the lower end of high TC leads at 8K, which is good enough for high TC leads, and also good enough for low TC leads in zero field, which has the 9.6 cooling TC. So at the 8K, actually, it has a larger cooling power. 180 milliwatt is not a problem. Okay, so that works. That solved the problem, the challenge of this system. So now I just let you know that everyone is doing quantum computer, and I'm not sure if this institute is doing this. I just let you know the Google recently found a new lab focusing on quantum computer, and they hire one of the most promised guy, which is John Martinez. Actually, this is the guy who worked with me on the ADR system, and he told me how this brass leads works about, I forgot, 15 years ago. This guy was and still is the professor of UCSB, and now he is hired by Google. He's the head of this Google lab focusing on quantum computer. He's a very promising guy, and everyone has a rumor that he will be the first guy who will make this, the usable quantum computer and get Nobel Prize. What I'm trying to say is this is a very good guy, and he just ordered a dilution from us to cool down his quantum computer, this circuit, okay? So if anyone here, you know, is working on quantum computer, you know, he's a good guy to talk. All right, so now the symposium asked me to give one word expectation on what's the future ULT. I said future is two things. One is cryogen-free, one is low or no vibration, right? Cryogen-free is no big deal. We have dry helium-3, which is here. You can see this is a typical test curve sent to me by a user. You can see after you got a 280 millikelvin for 60 hours, the drifting is only 2 millikelvin. It's very good. And the holding time is like 190 hours. So it's not a big deal. For then you can have a dry ADR, you got the 50 millikelvin. You can get the dry DR, you get 10 millikelvin. So dry is not a problem, it's resolved. So the problem is the no vibration, low vibration system. In particular, if people want a cryogen-free dilution, use pulse tube with compressor, with low vibration STM, with atomic resolution. This is the challenging part. And so far, really, there's no single stuff in the world which really meet all these requirements. Penn State University invited Janice to develop this system, and we are developing. And this is our preliminary design. You can see with a very complicated thing. Again, this is the bottom loading things with all this advantage. And here, without going details, I can tell you we designed a few line of defense to reduce the vibration. Hopefully, in 18 months, 1.5 years from today, we have this product. And for the time being, we don't know what's the vibration level. But something is coming. I think this is what I need to talk today. And thank you very much. Any questions? Oh, you're welcome.
And then, so what sort of, so you have some tie-up with them, or how do you, what is the model in which you work with the?
How do we develop the design?
Also, how do you, the commercialize?
Oh, the thing is the following. Actually, this is a very good question. People cannot believe all these systems are the first time in the world, okay? And when customer talk to me, talk to Janice, of course, we have an evaluation. Can we do it? Because there's nothing identical in the world, and we have not done identical thing. However, what we have is a theoretical background and a practical experience. This is something which is very difficult to say. It's very challenging to my job. It's very challenging. I've been at the Janice for 21 years. As of today, at least I have not failed one. Okay. So basically we do a very scientific analysis. Actually, I have another assistant, Russian scientist, and he is a PhD. He has a lot of experience on ERT also. Then also he has a lot of experience on doing silver sinter on dilution exchanges. We scientifically analyze. For example, this sub-Kelvin APAS. I did a lot of calculation, and also before that, I made a lot of a helium-3 system. So, based on all this knowledge, I say, okay, we can get below 1 Kelvin. Then, of course, after we deliver it, we give this system a model, these type of things. Okay. Did I answer your question?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. What's the
optical spectroscopy?
Optical thing is the thing. That's a very good question. I always tell people, optical ERT is very difficult. Okay. First of all, be honest with you, I'm not an optical person, and I don't have too much optical experience. Okay. The thing is the following. The thing is really, when people inquire an optical ERT system, basically my answer is the following. The best thing I can do is block all the windows, okay, with a blank port. Then I can guarantee you the performance. Then you do whatever you want, okay? Because first of all, when you put a window, you have to put a so-called anti-reflection window, these type of things. And I'm not expert. I just honestly tell you, and probably you're better than I tell my customers. Second of all, it really depends on the environment of your lab. If your lab is dark or if your lab is bright. So one very good example is one day our lab technician is testing a very simple optical systems. Okay, it's a 4K system. He say, Zuyu, how come I cannot cool down? Okay, you pass helium. I say, let me look at it. It happened to be there's a window, and this time is the sunshine. The sunshine just shining right at the window, these type of things. So I say, how can I specify? I cannot say, hey, you have to run your experiment with all lights off, these type of things. Okay, so this is where. However, we are collecting information. We try to do it. For example, the last example, this hybrid system. We put some window there. So also, for example, I can tell you, when we close all these shutters, we got the 13 millikelvin. So I did open the 3K shutter, let the mixing chamber seeing this 40 Kelvin shutter. We reached the 44 millikelvin. Then I opened that, it reaches like 96 millikelvin, this type of thing. We start collecting data. Yeah, but the important thing is I always honestly tell customer what I can do, what I cannot do. Never try to pretend we can do everything. No, that's right. That's the answer. Thank you. Yeah. Now, of course, another thing is really we found the real important thing, two important things. One is not just the clear view of the view of the window. It's really the solid angle, which is really dominant. The second thing is very interesting. We sold a lot of optical helium-3 systems. Actually, now we have a lot of good data on helium-3. On helium-3, now I'm in the good shape. I can quote guarantee performance for optical windows as long as the configuration is determined. And then we found it's very important to install a 1K radiation shield. You know, the thing is the following. My somehow I think this is the right feeling. When the light shine into the cryostat, the thing is there's a lot of scattering inside it. Yeah, and the scattering really is very big. So what happened is if you have a 1K, normally we have a 1K pot located above the helium-3. If we put a 1K shield, we should try to surround the helium-3 port as much as possible. Even you surround it more, then you put holes, then really block this scattering. That really improve the performance. This is the one, another big thing I found. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.